Okay, thank you, Oscar. That concludes our opening remarks. What we'll do now is go to a question and answer period. As I mentioned, your guest lines are on mute, but you can unmute your line by pressing star six. And if you would like to ask a question, please give your name and your media outlet and who your question is directed to. If for any reason you would prefer to text me a question, you're welcome to do that as well. It's 303-547-0030. But right now, I'll just open it up to the phones if we have a first question.
Yes, this is Erica Schaefer with meatandpoultry.com. My question is for Mr. Tseng. You were talking about how our closest neighbors opened up their markets within a few months after the BSE incident, and then the trading is about building relationships. How do you keep this message from getting lost, given that the focus of these renegotiations of trade agreements is about the folks who apparently didn't make out so well under those trade agreements?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the key thing for us, I think, is to, for those of us who feel that we've benefited greatly by NAFTA or by other trade agreements, I think it's incumbent upon us to extol the benefits of those agreements and to project it as loudly as possible. I think that from our standpoint in the meat industry, especially when you look at the beef industry, as I use that example of BSE, I think this really speaks to the benefits of not only having a great trade relationship, but a great relationship. And I just feel that the work that's been done over the years with our industry and the work that's done by our exporters, the whole export sector, the benefits that have been done with the development of relationships on the buy side in Mexico and Canada, these have been very dignified over the years for 25 years. And so these, what we call global value chains that have been developed, they're very hard to disrupt, but they can be, as Oscar alluded, that they are looking at Argentina, they're looking at South America, they're looking at Brazil. So, we protect these things. These are things that we work on at the USMEF and other cooperators is extolling our reliability as a supplier. That's one of the things that when we deal with countries around the world, one of the best benefits that we have is that if you're a country that's not totally self-sufficient, if you know that you can depend on the United States as a reliable supplier in good times and bad times, that is a very significant point. And at this point in time, that reliability has been called into question. And that makes it more difficult for us for the longer term because we're not just interested in the short-term benefits. We're interested in the long-term relationships. And so I think we really have to, as I say, those of us who have benefited from these agreements need to really shout this out and even do it more profoundly and more often than we are at the present.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll go to our next
good
question.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Steve Kay of Cattle Buyers Weekly.
Morning, Steve.
I have a question for you, Joel, regarding China and your remarks. You talked about the formidable challenge of selling the whole animal because of the natural requirements. So I have a two-part question. Of that 800 metric tons, do you know what percentage of the whole animal that represented? Are we still struggling to go beyond some of the high-value cuts? And secondly, are exporters getting enough of a premium so far in the market to be able to share some of that back with producers to encourage the production of more cattle that fit China's requirements?
Yeah, Steve, those are very good questions. Those are the questions we're asking ourselves at this point in this process. I don't have the breakout of cuts, unfortunately. Steve, you probably know we just don't have cut export data, but
right.
we are seeing a lot of these underutilized cuts being made available in the market. So it's not just the Asian cuts being sold. So that means the exporters are making those available. Last week, for example, we were doing some training sessions on sirloin cuts, which are not all that popular in other Asian countries, and we're also working on shoulder clods. And these are items that that we purchased in the market. So they're being sold right now. In other words, to the buyers. And you know, I want to emphasize that the buyers and the chains, they want to look at all the cuts. So when I made the comment about preconceived notions, maybe in other markets like Hong Kong where I live, it's all about, you know, boneless short ribs, the established items. That's all I want to take a look at. But in China, we're seeing this more open attitude, and they realize that some of the true value and some of the more reasonable cuts will be these underutilized cuts. So I mean, I see the willingness on both sides to try to make this work. And why are they trying to make it work? Because they do see value in featuring American beef. It does have, despite our absence there for 14 years, there is a high quality image about U.S. products. And to your next question, is there enough of a premium being on these cuts to be passed back? I think it's too early to tell. I don't have a recent estimate on what percent of our cattle supply is China compliant. I know it would be in the single digits, I would think, still. I still think we're just starting to see this play out right now. I mean, keep in mind, Steve, that really for the first month to 6 weeks, so it's only been in the last couple of months where we're seeing more steady imports of sea-shipped product. So the sea-shipped product has a much lower price point. So, ask me. I wish I could give you more of a definitive answer to that. But I think it's best to answer that next May, or in a couple months, because it's still playing out, just starting to play out.
Joel, a quick follow up: is there much interest and demand in China yet for offal items?
Yeah, no, good question. So offal, we're trying to clarify some issues. The Chinese government on the list of eligible offal. So yes, there's
right.
great interest in certain offals. For example, omasum is an item that I think we won't have to spend too much time trying to sell. They're very familiar with it, but we'll have some advantage over our competitors because none of our competitors have any offal access. So some of the items that we think we'll take will be items like. Skirts and hanger steaks, and perhaps tongues. So I know, my Japanese colleague are saying, oh, China, don't take all the tongues. We're not going to take all the tongues, right? But that would be an item that I think would be popular straight away on Korean barbecue. But they're just starting to test the system on offals because there's still a little bit of a discrepancy between the eligible offal lists on USDA and the China regulator website.
Joel, thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Does anyone else have a next question?
Yeah, this is Spencer Chase with AgriPulse. I have a question for really whoever would like it, but I'd appreciate it if Phil could chime in on this. Some of the comments that you made on NAFTA, I'd like to circle back to those. Hearing some comments from some other similar organizations, wondering legitimately if the Trump administration is negotiating in good faith here or if some of these proposals that they're offering are with the intention of giving themselves cover should they decide to withdraw from the agreement. Based on conversations that you've had with negotiators, and with administration officials, do you get the sense that this is a negotiation in good faith, or do you think they're trying to provide themselves cover for a withdrawal?
Well, I don't have the intricate details of all the motivations of the negotiators or the administration, but from what I've been able to observe from my exposure, I think they're dealing in very, very good faith. I don't doubt they're very resolute, they're very convinced and very motivated as far as trying to rectify trade imbalances. I'm reminded again when you take a look at the numbers, if you look at the U.S. trade deficit, there's really 77% of the U.S. trade deficit resides with three countries. It's China, the big one, Japan, and the EU. That means 23% of the trade deficit is completely outside of those three countries. And if you're going to try to rectify the trade deficit, you're never going to get that resolved in dealing with Mexico and Canada, even though they're huge trading partners, as I said, $1 trillion. You have to engage Japan, which we pulled out of when it came to TPP. You have to engage China, and you have to engage TTIP. And TTIP, we don't know what the disposition of that is, but these are the three major locomotives of the trade deficit, and until we address those countries in a very good faith effort on trade, we're not going to resolve the trade deficit.
Thank you. Next question.
Hello, this is Carrie Halliday from Western Livestock Journal. My question is specifically for Joel, because I'm interested mostly in Asian things I've heard lately. There have been some, I don't know, whispers is not exactly the right word, but that Japan might be considering dropping the additional tariffs on chilled. And my additional question is, I've heard a bit about some talks of renegotiating the Korean free trade agreement, and I was hoping you could comment on those.
Do you want to take the Japan?
This is Phil. In answering the question about Japan, I watched this quite closely. I don't know of any discussions that are going on or any discussions even within Japan at this point in time about dropping any duties on chilled. The duties that are set up in Japan were concluded. This whole arrangement was done under the Uruguay Round, and when the WTO was formed, that's when these duties were codified, basically. So the safeguards, all these types of things. So this has been going on since 1994, and of course, as you know, that was ratified. Any agreement is ratified by the Japanese Diet, and so there would have to be a Diet resolution or a decision to change this. And at this point in time, those discussions are not going on in the Diet.
Phil, just maybe to clarify, the duty hike that you referred to earlier, going from 38.5% to 50%, that's on frozen product.
That's right.
There is a similar safeguard for chilled, but we don't think we're likely to trigger it this year. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but we're watching it very closely because it's hard to determine exactly how much the frozen would be shipped to Japan as chilled. We do know that in August it went up 54%. So it is something for us to bear in mind. So as I said earlier, I think it's very concerning anytime a duty is increased, and we're watching this very, very closely because we take this very seriously.
But the safeguard is something that if we engage with Japan on that, it needs to be addressed on both the chilled and frozen
right.
side. It just
That's
happens
right.
to be an immediate problem on the frozen
That's
side.
Right.
Okay. Carrie, did you have anything else?
Joel had some.
I also had the question about the potential renegotiation of the Korean Free Trade Agreement.
This is Joel. I can't comment on where that might stand. I can only make a comment about the commercial impact. So I think just to echo what Phil said earlier in his opening remarks, and that is that tariffs are such an important determinant of our trade volume and our market share. So Korea is an interesting country because it does a lot of its trade with, especially in agriculture products, with countries with which it has free trade agreements. It has many free trade agreements. The U.S. Was one of the earliest ones to harvest an agreement. So, unlike Japan, we actually hold a tariff advantage with our competitors who signed trade agreements at a later stage. So we hold approximately a 5% tariff advantage over Australia. But both are phasing down from a very high duty of 40%. So the extent that any renegotiation will result in those tariffs going back up, that would hit us almost instantly. I think the impact could be significant in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Remember that we, the United States and other suppliers We compete often with domestic production. So the why do countries have tariffs? Because to protect their local industries. So to the extent that those bounce back, I think we'll lose, and the reaction would be swift.
I think you raise an important point. We've gone down from 40% to 24% since the Korea FTA was signed, but it's not, if you lost that, those reductions and went back, it's not as if everybody would be going back to 40%. Exactly. The Australians, the Canadians, New Zealanders, all of their beef is currently going in at well under 40%, not quite as low as ours, but it's not, it wouldn't be back to the pre-FTA days. It would be returning to a situation where you're at a huge disadvantage. Okay, thank you. Does someone have the next question?
Hi, this is Brett Fortin with Inside U.S. Trade. And the question is for Oscar. You had mentioned potential ramifications, Mr. Tsang mentioned potential ramifications of the increased demand in Mexico. I was wondering if thought there is that Mexico could in some way curb the U.S. exports to Mexico, whether or not that's part of the NAFTA renegotiation or Mexican demand. I mean, is there a sense that Mexico would retaliate in some way, or if some of the proposals the U.S. has put forward could lead to Mexican industry retaliating via trade remedy cases?
Well, I think number one is I think the Mexican government as well as the Canadian government have been stellar as far as their implementation of the NAFTA agreement. I think, as you know, trade cases are brought to the attention of governments by private industry. And that's always a concern if there would be any infraction or any misinterpretation or misunderstanding that there could be something. But so we're not only watching what the Mexican government is doing, but we're also watching what the Mexican industry is doing. So that's where these issues originate, and that's what we're monitoring at this point in time, especially in Mexico.
Yeah,
I mean, are you expecting the industry to raise an issue? I know that the industry did publicly say that U.S. meat exports would be one area that could face retaliation if a U.S. proposal on seasonal trade remedies were to go through.
Well, I think that's something that we've been steadily cautioning, I think, our negotiators, is that where we're enjoying success in these agreements, when people want to, if there's an issue that arises, and it might not even have anything to do with agriculture, it's usually the industries that have been successful are the ones that are targeted first. So because the meat industry has been successful, we stand out, and so there is that always that possibility that we could be hit first with something. But at this point in time, MEF is monitoring both on the private side and the government side to make sure that everything basically is going on as planned. So at this point, I don't see that as an issue. But again, we don't know what's going to happen in the next sets of negotiations going forward either.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Yeah, this is Erica Schaefer again with meatpoultry.com. Can someone or Mr. Hallstrom address growing demand in South Africa? Did that predate the outbreak of avian influenza there? Is there a link between the growth and maybe people replacing poultry as a protein?
Yes, this is Dan. I do think that there is a definite link in the modernization of the economies. As we see economies, especially in Africa, very developing regions, start to see further economic development, especially the emergence of the middle class, there tends to be this propensity to want to upgrade the protein level. So people that might have been consuming poultry, for example, might want to upgrade to pork and beef variety meats. I think we are seeing some of that. I do think it's also a function of market access. We regained market access into South Africa a year and a half ago, I believe it was. And it took some time, but especially on the beef side, it took some time, but once it got going, you know, it's like any market, it started to pick up some steam really fast. So I think this is indicative of regions that are very much in a developmental mode. The other thing that's very interesting about the African region as a whole, especially outside of South Africa, is you have one of the youngest demographics in the world. So you're going to see and a very fast population growth. So you're going to see some opportunity going forward in not only South Africa, but other regions like Angola, Ghana, Benin, some of these regions. So the outlook's, I think, very positive going forward.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have time for one or two more questions. Does anybody have any final questions for us today?
Yeah, this is Steve Kay of Cattle Buyers Weekly again. when the tariff increase occurred on August 1 on Japanese frozen imports from the U.S., there was a lot of talk amongst yourselves and trade groups that this really accelerated the need for a bilateral trade agreement between the U.S. and Japan, and yet I've heard virtually nothing about any progress on this as far as the administration is concerned. What's your take on it?
Well, Steve, I think, to be very frank, I think that as you know, the president is leaving for Asia on Friday. He's going to visit five countries in 12 days. That's a very aggressive, actually a very torrid schedule for even a young man. But I would say this, that when you take a look at the issues that is going to be he'll be facing, especially when he gets to Japan, security is the number one issue. And obviously with North Korea, that has become an overwhelming issue, not only for Japan, but South Korea, as well as the United States and all the neighbors in the Pacific. But in addition to that, when you take a look at the Japanese situation, from the Abe standpoint, who just won a very resounding victory in his election, you know, the defense issue is number one. North Korea defense, security, that's number one as far as they're concerned. Related to that, his next priority would be revamping the Constitution to rid themselves of Article 9. And then the third area they're looking at is revitalizing the economy. And they've had about 15 months of growth in Japan. It's been anemic. It's only been less 1% or on the average. But that's something that they're working on very aggressively. When it comes to revitalizing the economy, a subset to that, of course, would be their trade agenda. Their trade agenda is varied because, as you know, they're working right now very aggressively and taking the lead on the TPP-11. This week in Chiba, Japan, they're hosting the TPP-11 to try to conclude this by the by November this month. I think also they're also engaged in trying to conclude the EU agreement, and they're also working on an agreement with the RCEP, the Regional Cooperation Economic Partnership with China. So the U.S. FTA really comes in fourth place on that agreement. So Japan is already engaged in these areas. I don't see from this trip that it's going to advance our trade agenda as far as an FTA dramatically because of what I'm hearing and reading from the Japanese side. But from our standpoint and from the MEF standpoint I can speak of, I think we are interested in seeing whatever can be done, whether it be some form of a TPP engagement, which would be the quickest as far as acceptability in Japan and be the less acrimonious if we could. But if it's an FTA, we'd be happy to see that come to fruition as well. But I think that will take much, much longer, just looking at their trade agenda and their resources to deal with the U.S. on an FTA when they have all these other agreements they're working on presently.
Okay, maybe time
Thank
for
you,
one,
Phil.
Final, one
you bet.
Final question, if anybody has one last call for questions. Okay, thank you very much. We will be here in Tucson through Friday. If you have any follow-up you'd like to do, feel free to email me or call me, and I'll do my best to get your response. Thank you for calling today.